Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Collective Clicks podcast. This is your host, Brandon Bateman, and today I'm joined by Garrett Cragen from my team. We're going to talk about all kinds of fun stuff, but before we get too deep into it, we're going to start with a kind of fun technical nugget. Garrett, do you want to share that?
Yep. Okay, so before I get into this, this is a little bit on the higher end, but I'm going to be putting a Loom clip in the notes for this episode, so you can go and watch me do it in an account. So one of the big tactics we use with our clients is called a portfolio bidding. Basically, how that works is it lets you combine the data from different campaigns to pool the learnings of each of those campaigns into one bidding like model. The way we do it is we have that shared amongst all of our clients, all their campaigns. So the impact is a lot greater. But what I would recommend doing is if you are running your own PPC, I would still do portfolio bidding in your own account across all of your different campaigns you're running, and get a fraction of the benefit of that tactic that we use in your account. Because even in just one account, having those learnings pooled only benefits your performance. And it's a very easy way to use AI just that much more, in your PPC. And like I mentioned, I'll do a quick walkthrough of that process and put that in the notes for the episode.
Fantastic. Thank you, Garrett. It's a huge, huge value add and something that I've literally never seen done by anybody else in this industry. So there's a lot of value here. Let's talk about our topic for today. Our topic is shady or predatory things that agencies do in sales, or in general, working with real estate investors and those kinds of things. I want to give people that are listening a little bit of an idea of what to look out for. You know, what's a good sign? What's a bad sign? And some of these things are honest mistakes. Some of these things are malicious. We're just going to go through all the stuff that you should look for that you probably would end up knowing if you were to work with agency after agency. And after 10 years, just think like, what did I learn about how to choose the right partner to work with and how to not to choose the right partner? You'd probably end up with this list. We're going to talk about ownership of your account, different parts of the sales process and how they act in sales, different ways of problem solving throughout the whole process. And even some different campaign segmentations and little technical things like that, that can completely change your perspective of the results that you're getting and how basically all of these things can be twisted so that it looks really good or twisted so it looks really bad. Right. So we'll talk about it kind of without the spin. What is the whole world of how this works? So I'm excited to get into it. How are you doing today, Garrett?
Doing good. How are you?
Hey, fantastic. I'm happy you're back after what appears to be a really bad stomach flu, was it?
Yeah, yeah. I've been sick for about 2 weeks with a crazy bug that got me, my wife, my kids. But I think we're just about out of the woods on it.
Yeah, the wonderful world of school starting up again and all the germs going around and the colder weather and all that fun stuff. Yeah, super, super grateful to have you back though and be back at it. So anyways, our topic today is shady and predatory things that marketing agencies do. I think it's an interesting topic because there's a lot to potentially unpack here. And it just comes down to the more you know who to partner with, the more you know how to make those decisions that are going to help grow your business. And you know what to look out for, right? These are the kind of things that people learn with experience. But companies do these things for a reason, right? And you kind of have to sometimes go through the process in order to figure this stuff out. So we've got three separate things. I'm going to start off with the first one. And this comes down to who owns the ad account, which is something that honestly, a lot of people, their first time working with an agency, they don't even think about it, right? But this has a massive, massive impact on your future as a company. So could you share a little bit, Garrett, about like account ownership, what's normal, what some people do, what you want to look out for?
Yeah. So I think the there's a like red flag and a green flag with this, you know, like how this is handled by an agency. The like normal, good, like honest practice is the client makes the account. That way they own the data. And like if things don't work out, if things change, when we part ways, the client still owns all that data. They own the account still. What happens sometimes is agencies will try to strong arm clients into staying around by requiring that they, the agency, make and own the account. That they couch that as like, you know, our way of doing it is like is very like proprietary and secret, and if you own it, then you know other agencies could steal our secret sauce. But really what they're doing is they're giving themselves some added leverage to, you know, keep you as a client longer because they own the data. And if you leave, your account will likely see a dip in performance.
Yeah. I think we have to think really hard, right? Because do advertising companies want to keep their clients? Yes. Should they do everything that they can to do that? Yes. But I think you have to think really, really hard anytime what you're starting to do to keep your clients is something that's not in their best interest, right? We want to retain business, not because people are forced or strong-armed into it, but because they're getting value through that. And this is just one of those things where like I consider it a dirty trick. Like I and I'm sure someone's going to hate me for saying this, but not that many people, honestly, because it's not crazy common, although it's more common in this industry than it is in other industries. But I think it's a dirty trick because most people, when they sign that paper, they don't know what they're getting into. And they end up at some future date being in a hurtful place because they essentially have this other company doing all this marketing for them, but they don't own any of the marketing that that company produced. When you hire an agency, you hire them to work on your behalf. That means they're building things for you. That means you should be able to keep that intellectual property when they leave. I mean, what is a company? What's the value of a company, right? It's the intellectual property and it's the people. If you don't have that IP, then you're just forced to take a step back when you stop working with this company because you have to start with a new account. You have to start with new data. Even if you have no intention to like copy their strategies or anything like that, the account is where so much of the value is had. And that's why they want to keep on controlling it. So how do you know if this is an issue or not?
Well, I think it's, well, hang on. What do you mean? How do you know if it's an issue?
Let's just say I'm in the sales process with a company and I'm trying to figure out like, can I own the account? Can I not? Like what kind of questions do I ask them? How will I know that this is set up properly? What kind of contract terms am I looking for?
Like when you're being sold, like, how do you like make sure that this isn't being done to you?
Yes.
Yeah. I would just ask them point blank, like, will I own the account or will you own the account? And when we part ways, will I be able to take it with me?
Yeah. I think that's a fair way to do it. Right. And you know, hopefully you get access to your account. I think the other aspect of this is transparency too. Companies keep that stuff really close because that means is that you can't hold them accountable to how well they're actually doing because you actually see the results. It's like me being a salesperson and telling you, I don't want you to be able to look at how many appointments I'm going on or how many leads I get or how well I'm following up with them or anything. You're just going to get whatever sales you get and that's it. Yeah. You can't do that as a salesperson, right? Because it removes all the transparency. And it's not like theoretically, if you're closing really well, do I care about every one of those individual things? Maybe a little bit, but ultimately it's the end result that I care about more than anything, right? It's the result. It's how much are you selling? But if I don't have access to that, then it just removes this amount of transparency that just should be natural to the relationship so that we can have, that mutual respect and know what we're each doing. I think it's a not allowing your clients to access their own accounts is a really good way to make it so they can also never find out that you made a mistake or that the amount of spend that you say you had was actually different. So maybe they're overpaying for their spend, mm-hmm. Or not be able to hold you accountable to the fact that most of their bad quality leads were because of these search terms that they're not able to review because you call them proprietary, which proprietary just means I don't want you to see it. And because like all the best marketers, they don't have anything proprietary because they're just moving so fast forward that like in this podcast, we publish all the stuff we do for anybody, including our competitors, to look at and try to execute. But that's okay because we're always moving forward so fast that we'll always have an edge. I think once you start thinking scarcely, like this is all we have. And if someone were to get this, like if your secret sauce is that simple, then it's not a secret sauce.
Right. And I mean, I would just say that if they claim that they have a secret sauce and they have to hide it, it probably isn't that good of a secret sauce. And frankly, like you said, like there isn't a secret sauce as far as like how you're like, you're, as far as how you build an account, like there's just not. And, if that's like their claim, to me, that's a major red flag that gives you an insight into how they're going to behave throughout your partnership. So like of everything that we discuss here, that to me is like the biggest red flag is them not giving access to the account. Because it's just a lack of trust, a lack of like equality in the partnership. And, it's not because they have this crazy, amazing formula that works every time, because it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's something to that. And just thinking, does this behavior in this one way reflect what you might do in other things, right? Because as soon as a company, you start branching into doing things that aren't in your best client's interest so that you can make more money from them, how far are you willing to go down that path? There might be a lot of other things, right? And it's really easy for like company leaders to be disincentivized. One example I'm thinking of this is Facebook. So Facebook, the way it works, if you create the account, then it's impossible to transfer permanent ownership to someone else. There's a weird thing of how it works. And so many companies, like even because it's like, it's easier to do it on behalf of the client, right? So then we're taking clients through our onboarding process with Facebook ads. That's actually a little bit more complicated. And they're like, this is more cumbersome. Why am I doing this in a way that's harder than our previous agency? It's because I firmly believe that everybody needs to own their own IP. If you're not going to own your own IP, you might as well just go do paper lead, right? Buy someone else's leads. There's maybe if they ran ads for you, it would be on your brand or something. But the IP is like the single most valuable thing in all of digital marketing for real estate investors, if you ask me, right? So that's why we feel so firmly about that even when our clients are saying, no, I don't want that, it's a little bit harder to go down that path, we take them down that path anyways, because that's what's better for them. Right. I think that's the mindset that you have to have as a company. At the end of the day, we retain clients through doing what's best for them, not through strong arming them into something that's not actually good for them. And it's like you said, super slippery slope. Any other comments on this before we go to number two?
Nope.
All right. Let's talk about how they act in sales, what they do in sales for different companies. Cause everybody kind of has their own style, right? I'm curious to hear from you, Garrett, any like red flags in the sales process in terms of how they're, you know, how they're marketing themselves, how they're selling themselves, that shows you that this could be a shady company.
I mean, I think the like an agency salesperson's favorite tool is the audit, right? Because audits are a great way to look like you're a freaking marketing genius. Show every small thing going wrong as a major red flag that's going to, you know, tank your business. And give the impression to, in general, a less educated audience than the agency, how all of these things going wrong are bad and how they're going to do all these things better and it's going to be perfect. So what I would say is, if they do want to do an audit, that I think that's great, because then they're giving you more personalized context. But I would watch to see where they, like, if everything they find is bad, And if they don't show things going well, then they're being disingenuous. So I would say that in the audit, look for over-promising, exaggerating problems and focusing solely on problems. And then I would even say, like, have that audit, like, cross-checked by someone else and see if what they're saying is even valid. Because often those audits are done by a sales rep that isn't going to be in the platform with you. And they're just trained on, like, things to look at and things to say, and it might not even be true.
Yeah, you're totally right. And I've heard so many audits, because this happens to our clients sometimes, right? And this comes as a virtue of our clients having access to their accounts and data. They can also take a third party and they can choose to audit our work. Which I think is a right that they should have, right? But then I see these agencies create this whole, like, video about all these things that are wrong. And really, what's wrong? Like, for example, classic example, your conversion rate's really low. So you have all these issues with your landing page, et cetera, when they don't understand that we're doing lead sculpting. And because we're sculpting leads, which, if you don't know what that is, listen to some previous episodes and learn about that, et cetera, then it makes our conversion rate look low. So now you're looking at the cost per conversion, and you're assuming that's cost per lead when it's not actually cost per lead. And it's because you don't actually understand the strategy in the account. And you're just a salesperson looking at a Google Ads account and trying to make decisions. I had a client reach out to me the other day, and they're like, this person found all these issues with their account. And I'm like, well, welcome to having anybody do an audit for you. We went through them one by one and, like, proved how each one of those things is, like, completely invalid. And it's literally just misunderstandings, right? They're projecting their strategy onto you and assuming it should be the same for your business without really understanding your business. So yeah, you have to be so careful with audits. Sometimes people will find a lot of stuff. Like, when we do audits, we can sometimes find, like, a lot of wasted spend and stuff like that. But I think there should be data to back it up. The problem is where an idea becomes, like, the gospel of what is right for your account. Like, I don't love the way that the ad is written. I want it this way. If you're going to say that in an audit, cool. Either you have to say, well, this is an idea that I have, but I don't know how it would work. Or you have to say, I've tested this before and this is the result of the test that I did. And therefore it could do something for you, right? If we're truly data driven, then we're going to make a big difference. If you added up all the things that marketing companies said were going to be improved through audits compared to what actually got improved, like, it'd be horrible, mm-hmm. right? Because most of the time this doesn't actually pan out.
Yep. Yeah. I think that audits, when done correctly, are a great way to get some, like, honest feedback. But when they are done based on scare tactics, that's when they're harmful, and you're not getting the agency's true ability to assess and optimize an account. You're getting a rep that's saying, here's everything wrong. Here's everything that we could possibly see. Maybe, probably not. And, you know, we're your answered prayer. And yeah. It's not usually true.
Yep. Totally agreed. Or it's at least a little bit misleading.
Yeah.
Most of the time. Right? So you kind of have to take it with a grain of salt. I think another thing that agencies do, a pretty good differentiator from, like, a really high quality agency to one that's a little bit more shady, is what kind of expectations do they set for results? Because here's the thing, agency sales is actually really, really easy. All you do is you just tell people you're going to get this result. You want to pay for it or not? And they say, yes, I want to pay for it. And you bring them on. Then what happens is your company gets a horrible reputation because you're making promises that you can't actually keep. Right. So the art of, like, building these partnerships, but with the right expectations, is actually really hard. And I think you'll very commonly see that agencies that are a little bit more shady, they're making a lot of promises about results, or setting really firm expectations about results, when in reality, they can't actually control those things that well. And when they have a lot of experience, then they either have to decide, am I going to continue to set this expectation, even though I know that's not true, in which case they're lying, or they have to kind of shape up and be honest, because no company bats at 100%, right? And they should be upfront with you about that from the very beginning, that not every one of these stories has success, and the things vary a lot. At the end of the day, some clients are going to be very successful and some clients are going to be less successful. And I think only talking about the one group and not about the others is just some sort of like blissful ignorance of reality that is nice to have, but I don't think it's setting fair expectations when you're with your partners, when you're starting to negotiate deals to work with them to hopefully take your business to the next level.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's true. I think like if like the outcome range is from like here to here, they'll skew like kind of their like top 5% of outcomes that they've seen like maybe twice. What we do just to kind of give like a different like perspective is we will like work with our client, get an idea of what they want to see as far as like results go. And then we'll backtrack, you know, that end outcome of ROI or cost per deal and show them what cost per lead we would need to hit that and like, show how that like fits within our likely outcome range and help them like decide if like that those outcomes, you know, work for them, you know, like fit what they're looking for and like have them be involved in the decision. That way, when they do work with us and things start to, you know, roll in, they see results, they match up with what they expected. They're happy, we're happy, and their business is in a place where they have the staff in place to handle the results that they were promised, right? Like things go poorly when results are overpromised. Eventually everyone loses that game, besides the rep in that first meeting who gets that sale. Right.
Yeah. And like 10% of the clients who actually get that result that they promised.
Sure.
Which you just have to know if you're saying things like that, you're screwing over 90% of your clients. Right. I know there's always that 10%. I think, but honestly, you and I have experienced this because we manage a sales team. It's a sales personality. This is something you have to like actively fight against as a company, because what do salespeople do? Like salespeople are undaunted by failure. That is the sales personality. What that means is, like, I can tell you, I walk into a room with 10 light bulbs. One of them's out. 9 of them are on. I say, what's wrong with the one? Why is that not on? A sales personality could walk into a room with 10 light bulbs. 9 of them are out. One of them's on and say, that is awesome. That light bulb's on. And then they'll go tell 90%. The whole world. Yes. They'll go tell the whole world about how they got their light bulb on. And you know, it doesn't matter, right? Because they every time the light bulb goes out, it's fine, right? We don't care because we're so relentlessly focused on the right thing. And they're optimistic, right? I mean, at the end of the day, like this is a – so this, I think, even ranges – it goes away from just the concept of shady companies, because I think that many companies do this with good intentions even. And we have to be really careful that our sales team doesn't start to do this just like wanting – and hoping that something could be true. Like what does a visionary person do if they want and hope that something's true? Like they already believe that it is because they're there, they're living in the future, right? They think that this can happen and they have that relentless optimism, and you need that. But the place for that is not when you're giving someone expectations for them to decide if they want to invest money in something or not, right? There's a point, there's a place to be like really, really level-headed, and there's a place to be really optimistic, and you just have to be so careful about it in what you say. Another case where I think this comes into play is case studies. I love looking at case studies for marketing companies because it's so telling what you see in the case study. How do you think case studies are built in misleading ways sometimes?
I think there's a few ways that they're skewed. The first one is they're based off of like the best month of the client ever. And they like, you know, take out all of the months of learning or of dips or of, you know, challenges. They're vague where they don't know what worked, like why that like one client popped. And so like what they like explain in the like, in that like write up is very vague because they don't know. Or it's not their average outcome, right? Like they have one client who just blew up. It's not standard. The outcome is like unmatched in their like most common range outcomes, right? And they push that as like, see, we can get you 35x. And it's like, you did it once over a month. That's awesome, right? And so I think that's, it's in general going to be vague. It's going to be skewed, and it's going to be an unlikely outcome.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with you. I even had Shannon on the podcast the other day, and we talked about a client of hers that has 100x return. You bet we're not making a case study.
Make it a case study, baby.
We're not making that a case study, right? Because that's not normal, right? Unless we have like repeatable, solidified results. That's why I hate case studies that are like, oh, look, Garrett got a deal after 14 days or whatever the case is. Like, if I was a casino, I could make case studies that make you believe that you can make money coming into my casino. Like, hey, look, Garrett won the jackpot. He only spent $20 and then he made $2,000, right? Does that mean casinos are places where it's smart to go spend $20 if you're trying to make money? Probably not, right? Even a blind squirrel finds a nut sometimes, right? And unfortunately, those nuts are the ones that become case studies, and all the nuts they were supposed to find that they didn't never become a case study. Mm-hmm. So it's a definitely a wild world of case studies. I think the best case studies, though, show like a decent sample size, right? So we're not just showing something that random variation explains this, right? That's the casino example, right? Does somebody go into a casino and leave with more money? Yes. Does the average person go into a casino and leave with more money? No, that's not how they work. So you need sample size, right? If a casino could show me that someone went in and spent $1 million there over 3 years and ended up with more money, then maybe I'd believe something, right? But you want to, you want to understand what that larger sample size. And then definitely they should be able to share like what contributes to the outcome. And the other thing is like, and I think we might be the only company ever in the world that does this. So maybe all the other, I'm not calling every other company in the world shady, but typical clients, typical results. How many times have I rejected even a case study that we wanted to publish that has even a good amount of data that shows a result that's just not typical of our clients?
A lot.
I reject every one of them. Mm-hmm. Why do I do that? It's because I don't want to set an expectation for someone else that we're going to get them that kind of result. I think when you publish a case study, you're basically saying, we did this for them, we could do it for you too. If we did this for them and it had a result that's four times better than what I thought it would be and four times better than I know how to replicate, am I going to say I could do it for you? No, I think that'd be disingenuous of me. So I think there's definitely a lot to unpack there in terms of like saying the right things. And really, I think the best example here, if we're just talking about like shady versus not shady, I'll give like two polar examples. We all know some of the like not as good actors in the real estate investment space with like coaching programs and education or something like that. Right. So what do those companies advertise? Right. They're education companies. They advertise, well, Garrett came in and within 30 days he made this much money and look at this check. You can see this picture of the check. And I'm not saying all the advertising like this is wrong, but I'm saying like that's an example of an education company. Then say like what's the most reputable education company you can think of? One that comes to my mind is Harvard, right? Very reputable education company. They're a college. They've been around for a long time. What does Harvard do? They don't advertise that Garrett came in and he got this job and went and made all this money, right? But what they do is they publish the total population, not just a sample of the population, because it's not misleading, right? So they say, well, people that come here, they generally grow like this in their education, and they generally get placed into jobs like this. And the average starting salary of somebody leaving Harvard with this degree is this, et cetera, right? That in my mind is quality marketing, because they're measuring the whole population, not just the sample, because they have the whole population. And when you just give samples, you can mislead, right? I could just take someone who went to Harvard and I could say, well, this person went there and then they ended up getting this horrible job and they never like got that great of an education, never made that much money in their life. I could find someone like that and I could say that's my sample for Harvard, and I could advertise that and make them look bad, right? Or you could take the best one and make them look too good. But the most reputable companies, they advertise averages and typical results, because those are actually good enough to be exciting, rather than having to like pick through and find their top 1% of students or clients or whatever the case is to make it look like it's worth working with them.
Yep, I agree. Yeah. If every agency published just their like median outcome, it'd be a very different ballgame than if they, you know, do what they usually do, which is their top 1% outcome.
Yeah, half of them would be out of business. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of really good actors in this space. I'm not speaking about all other companies here. There are really good actors. This just gives you some idea of like things to watch out for, to understand kind of some of the patterns, because the unfortunate truth of this industry, digital marketing being the one I'm referring to, although it could be said for real estate as well, is there's always people coming in and out, right? So you have to kind of have to know and you can start to learn these things. All right, let's talk about the last one. This is something that happens once you actually work with the company. And it's that the shadier marketing companies generally think that spending more money is always the answer to whatever problem you have. It doesn't matter what the problem is. What's the answer? Double the budget. What do you think about that?
I think it kind of is based in two principles. One, most agencies are priced in a way to be incentivized to increase the spend in the account. So there's already kind of a built-in incentive without, you know, the right mindset to push for higher spend. And then the other is that marketing is easier with more budget. There's more room to test. There's room for error. You have more data to learn faster. And so a marketer that lacks a lot of touch and knowledge is going to always default to, you know, if we spent more, things would improve. And that's a crutch. And I believe personally that, and I think this is also your belief too, is there is a point where more budget actually hurts the account, where like you start to see results deteriorate because you're overspending for the same results. And an agency that's shady isn't going to have that mindset because it doesn't match up with their like most immediate incentive of like increasing your monthly retainer. And budget can be the answer when it's viable and when there's a like very specific reason why it's gonna fix a very like explained problem. But when it's used as a boogeyman for the account doing well, that puts all of the onus on the client to just like dump more money into this hole. It like kind of like wipes the hands of the agency from being the problem.
Yep. I totally understand. And I think there's a good way to simplify this. Generally, all issues that you have in marketing can be summarized into three categories. Number one is efficiency. Number two is volume. Number three is consistency. And you have different solutions for different problems, right? So here's where people go wrong, right? I talked to a company that dealt with an agency that was sort of misleading them on this just the other day. They say they start with this company. They start with like a $5,000 a month budget. They don't get the result that they're looking for. They got like a $800 cost per lead or something, which for their market was 2 to 3 times what they should have. And the lead quality wasn't anything special, right? It's not all about cost per lead, but basically the metrics weren't trending the right direction. So what did the agency say? Well, they said, you have to double your budget and then we'll do better. So the next month, double the budget. What happens? The cost per lead's even higher. So what does the agency say? Well, now you have to double your budget again. So now they're at a $20,000 monthly budget. And then the cost per lead goes from there all the way up to $1,200 and the quality's still nothing special, not what they need to hit their results. And at that point, they just quit. It's like, okay, we've doubled our budget 3 times now and you know we're spending way more money and we're not getting there. So why did that not work? It's because you solved an efficiency problem by adding volume. That never works. It's like taking a sales team that can't close and giving them more leads and assuming that's going to make them close. It never works, right? It's never the right answer. So people that are less competent, though, they see less fine distinctions. Right? So they don't understand that like because maybe one time I told a client to increase their budget and it did work, right? But we have to think of when does it work. So for efficiency, it does not work. For volume, so let's just say you have the right efficiency. So you're getting like the right cost per deal, the right ROI, and you just need to do more of it. You need to get more deals. Budget increase is absolutely the right move in that circumstance. And then consistency is sort of an interesting one because there's two different facets of consistency. One facet of consistency is random variation. If random variation is your problem, like this happens to a lot of our clients that maybe have enough budget for like 1 to 2 deals per month. They're like, well, but this month I didn't get a deal. And then this other month I get 3 deals, et cetera, right? That level of consistency is just random variation. You could have like you're flipping your coin perfectly consistently. It's just sometimes you get 3 tails in a row and that's just what happens, right?
Yep.
More volume does fix that. If your problem with consistency is that you're managing the account really well, and then sometimes you really let your bids run wild and you're not getting the right kind of, results because it's not being managed properly, that's a type of consistency that isn't fixed by more volume. So consistency kind of can go either way. Sometimes it's poor management and sometimes it's just like the nature of the game. We get a lot of it due to the nature of the game and clients thinking that it's something with management when really it's like the nature of the game. But in those situations, volume fixes that because now you're just flipping your coin more often and it doesn't actually fix it, right? You're still just subject to the same laws of random variation that exists in the world, but it feels like it fixes it because your perception is that it's more consistent because you now might do in 1 month what you used to do in a quarter from a budget standpoint. So it's reasonable to assume that you'll be as consistent month to month as you would have been quarter to quarter before. So sorry for going like way too deep in that, but that's like in my mind, when I think like, what problems do you solve with more budget? There's a select few problems that you can solve with more budget. And if you have an inefficient campaign, more budget is not going to be the answer to your problem. And the shady agency will tell you that it is. And it's just a really painful, really expensive lesson to learn.
Yep. I agree. Gets ugly.
Yes. Sorry for the soapbox.
That's great.
Okay. One last thing that I want to talk about. Let's talk about performance-based agencies. I think this is a really fun topic because there's a lot of opinions on it. And my belief is that it's a misalignment of incentives. And I sometimes feel like I stand alone in that belief. I don't know if you share that belief. We haven't really talked about this much, but let's talk about like performance-based pricing, where it comes from, what people do. And then do you think it's a good idea or do you not?
Yeah. So to like give an example of this, it's like if an agency says like, you only pay us if we get you, you know, this result, you know, these number of deals, otherwise we're a free service. And I think that like, that's a great offer for like marketing. Like, of course, like it's free unless I make money. Heck yeah. Like sign me up. But the trick there is, it's kind of like in pay per lead where like they like build in, disputes into their price. Right. And then they like raise the price as you dispute. That's how this is too, where they're betting that enough clients won't dispute that they didn't get results, that they'll win in the aggregate. So it doesn't mean that they're this like bleeding heart agency that, you know, doesn't want to be paid for bad work. Like they still want to be paid. They're just betting that this offer brings in enough clients that they can win in the aggregate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a super neat perspective. That was a little bit different with mine, but I agree with it. Some other flavor I'd add to it is that I see this kind of go one of two ways. Either it's kind of a bait and switch, right? So it sounds like that. And then like the terms and conditions are ridiculous. And then it's like weird stuff like, or you don't pay us, but actually you do pay us just only for like the first 9 months, but then we'll work for free until you get your result. But you still have to spend $5,000 a month on advertising. You're never going to spend that for years until we can get you results, right? If we haven't already. And, you know, so there's just like little things in the fine print that make it just like completely irrelevant where it's just, it's a cool hook for marketing and that's it. The other thing I see is there are actually true performance-based agencies out there that legitimately will just get paid based on performance. and they don't rely on the numbers like you were talking about. But they have a way different model. Because I've known some of these companies, I know how they operate. So the way that it works is they take on a ton of clients, and then they put kind of bare minimum work into each of those clients. And when one of them takes off based on, you know, natural variation or whatever the case is, then they get paid well on it. And that's how they make their money. It's kind of like, let's just say I told you, hey, I'm the best at sales. I'm going to be your freelance acquisitions manager. So why do people generally not use freelance acquisitions managers? Well, because what I could do as a freelance acquisitions manager is now I can make contracts like that with the top 100 companies across the United States. But I'm just one person, right? So guess what I end up doing? Cherry picking. Because I, like, you send me leads. Am I going to show up and knock on that person's door if they haven't answered the phone? No, because I'll just have an agreement with someone else who will give me an easier lead to close, right? Am I going to say that your leads are good or that they're bad? I'm going to say that they're bad. Am I going to follow up with someone 40 times or one time and see if I can get them like right off the bat, but then just give up on them after that? I'm probably going to give up right after that because I have an unlimited lead flow, right? Same thing happens with agencies where like what you really want is the equivalent of like an in-house acquisitions manager with like really good accountability around all the metrics where they are going to squeeze every last drop out of that lemon. That's what you need from an agency that's managing your marketing. But you can't expect them to do that if you're not paying them to do that. That's why I love these really attractive looking agencies that are like low price, or maybe it's a flat price and it doesn't scale as you go up. That's one of my favorite ones, right? Like, oh, if you have a $1,000 budget with us, or you have a $100,000 budget with us, we're still just going to charge you $1,000 to manage it. You know what some people think about that? They think, I'm going to save so much money when I'm spending $100,000 later. You know what I hear when I hear that is I'm going to be underfunding the heck out of my campaigns when I'm spending $100,000 a month, and the opportunity cost of that is going to be massive. You can't do that, right? That's not actually what's in your best interest. So there's a lot of things that look better than they actually are. I think performance-based pricing is totally in that category because those companies, they don't care about your success as much as if you were like their sole client. What they care about is, can they play the numbers game and can they have success with a small number of projects, which are the easiest projects, which means that if finding success for you is hard, then they will give up early.
Yep, I agree. And I think one other, this probably isn't as common, but when an agency is comped on performance, they're going to haggle over like lead quality, lead attribution, you know, how your team like worked the leads, like all kinds of things, way more than if they're just paid like a retainer. And that doesn't align the like you and the agency as a partner. You're working like as enemies over who's getting paid and who's not getting paid. And I think that's just a really toxic setup, because it puts you in an adversarial like spot as the client, where you're having to fight your agency over if you should or shouldn't pay them. And like, that's just not going to lead to an awesome outcome for you as the client.
Yeah.
Almost always.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. You just brought to mind for me another thing that falls in this category, which is taking credit for, I don't know what the word is, like easier than normal lead gen methods. Classic example, branded traffic, right? If you're working with a high level agency, what they should do is they should be helping you understand the difference between branded and unbranded traffic. So the distinction here, branded traffic. So this is the super simple. Let's make it about Bateman Collective, right? If you're online, you're searching for Bateman Collective and you find us, and then we get you with a PPC ad, you fill out that form. What value did PPC add in that circumstance? It added something, right? We caught you. Maybe one of our competitors would have been in the ad spot, whatever the case is. If that ad wasn't there, would you have like found us somehow? Would you probably scroll down to the organic results and clicked on that? there's a high likelihood of that, right? What's the source of that lead? Probably not PPC, right? Could we say that PPC assisted that? Is PPC the net that caught that lead? Yes. Is PPC the source of that lead? No, because if someone's searching for Bateman Collective, they heard about Bateman Collective somewhere else first. Nobody just searches that randomly, right? So wherever they heard about that first, that's where they came from. Versus if someone's searching for like sell your house fast or whatever the case is, and then you bid on that, like there's a great chance that they didn't know about you before. So this branded traffic, you kind of have like a really strong advantage on. I recently did an audit with someone in this industry where we looked at their PPC, and what they're saying is actually, I'm pretty happy with the company I'm working with. We've got like a 5x return or whatever the case was. I said, I know you're doing a lot of TV ads. You're doing radio ads. You're doing mail with your brand. You have a really strong brand. Are you differentiating your branded traffic from your unbranded traffic? They said, what is that? Basically. Mm-hmm. So we go through this process of separating things out in their account. What we find, the results from non-branded are almost abysmal. They're getting so little. And then most of the deals they're getting through PPC are coming through this branded. So where they spend 90% of their budget was this unbranded stuff. And where they spend 10% of their budget was generating most of their results, that shouldn't actually be attributed to that, right? But they were kind of meshing it all together. So they thought that PPC as a whole is going well. When what's happening is that one thing is kind of overly taking the attribution, and the other thing is being bolstered by that, right? You'll find this everywhere in your business, right? Where success of one thing kind of covers up the failure of another. It happens in PPC all the time. So I've seen that with like performance-based agencies where they'll literally like get you a lot of branded traffic and then get paid on that for like just collecting it in a net, basically, like all these fish that you would have caught anyways. But even with other companies that are working with you that aren't differentiating like leads from retargeting versus not from retargeting, leads from branded traffic versus unbranded traffic, for example, where it is in your best interest to understand those things, because otherwise what happens is you keep on scaling your budget. But when you scale, you don't scale branded, because branded doesn't take that much budget, right? So when you scale, you're scaling the part of the campaign that doesn't work. And so many companies I've talked to where they're like, PPC works, but it doesn't scale. Every time I double my budget, I only get like one or two extra leads per month. It's because they're scaling the thing that wasn't actually generating the leads in the first place, because they didn't understand the distinction between the branded and unbranded. So it appears like it's a diminishing return problem, when really it's a misunderstanding of the nature of the advertising and understanding what comes from one campaign versus the other.
Yeah. And I think that brought up one last thing that I was thinking about with these agencies that are paid by performance. It's important to look at what they're paid for. If they're paid for deals versus if they're paid for leads, that's a drastically different goal that they're aiming, that they're working towards. If they're paid for leads, guess what? Getting a bunch of junk leads from display, wherever, you know, versus if they're paid, you know, by deals, that they might push more on branded, right? Or like, you know, blend those together. So it's important that when they are paid for performance, being like mindful of what is going to be incentivized based on that comp plan is important to kind of be aware of.
Yep. No, I totally agree. So we talked about a whole bunch of stuff today. For the sake of everybody listening, I'm just going to like kind of summarize like the main points here, just so you know, like what to go home with, what to focus on when you're looking for an agency here. So first thing in the sales conversation, make sure you ask them who owns the account. You make sure you are the direct owner of the account. It's important for transparency. It's important the moment you leave them in the future. And it tells you what kind of company they are. And I think that matters a ton. Number two, work with people who are setting fair expectations in sales, aren't overpromising, aren't just ignoring all the negatives and focusing on the positives, who have case studies that are legitimate over long periods of time with ample sample size, all those kinds of things. Number three, make sure that you're understanding the different campaigns that you're running and that you're attributing things properly. The one about skewing towards higher budget to answer all your problems, that's a problem, but you don't really know that until after you've worked with them. So not as helpful in the sales process as it is after the sales process. But I definitely think that that's one to focus on as well. The way that we are structured, for everybody's information, because we talked about what not to do. Let's talk about what to do. Yes, you should own all your data. As for like pricing structure and all that kind of stuff, what I believe in, and some people will tell you this isn't the right pricing structure, I found that this works the best in terms of how it's incentivizing my team. What we'll do is the larger the spend and the number of channels, the higher the management fee. That is because all of our processes are built so that they scale with that, right? So you should have your agency increasing with you spending more, but it should not be directly proportionate. It should be kind of like a sliding scale going a little bit further down because you need more resources. We just took on a client that was spending $100,000 a month and they were paying a flat agency fee to manage it. And they've increased their results drastically since working with us because that they were underfunding their management. They viewed it as they were saving money, but they were actually underfunding their management. We are charging them more than 7 times what they were being charged before, but their bottom line profits are significantly, significantly higher. So there's something to be said for that. So, and then you want a company that's incentivizing their team based on the retention of you as the client. That's the most important thing. It combines results, it combines good service, all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of how we focus as a company. And I think you'll find a lot of other companies that do something similar. And the reason is because it works. It balances incentives properly and everything like that. As long as you have your team kind of measuring the right things. The only thing that some people have a problem with is that the agency fee scales with more spend. But I think it's necessary. And the reason is it incentivizes the team to get better results so that the client scales spend. And then additionally, it allows the company to provide more resources as the account scales. Because if you get caught in flat pricing, you just end up scaling out of your company that's managing things. And at some point, you're just not putting the resources into management that you should be. Yep. Fantastic. Well, thank you for everybody that joined us for this episode of the Collective Clicks podcast. I will see you next time.